From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll speak with reporters from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about their recent investigation on how electrical fires affect the city's Black residents. Then we'll look at how the events on 9/11 are taught in the classroom today, 20 years later.
A lot of the textbooks in early curriculum, which hasn't necessarily changed that much, was written at a time when everyone had witnessed it. And so they haven't necessarily gone back and revised things for now students who have no clue about it.
Plus, culinary historian Adrian Miller shares how he's working to restore African Americans to the center of America's barbecue history.
But then we get to the 2000s, and almost every major story about barbecue that shows up on TV or in magazines or something excludes African Americans or marginalizes them.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with a recent investigation by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It found that Black renters are disproportionately impacted by electrical fires in the city. It also found these electrical fires happen five times more often in the city's 53206 zip code. Electrical fires are preventable, with maintenance and proper care. But negligence from landlords and a lack of accountability has left renters without a place to live. And some of these fires have been fatal. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang spoke with two Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporters about their investigation. Daphne Chen is an investigation and data reporter, and John Diedrich is an investigative reporter at the Sentinel.
At first, we were just looking at electrical fires. We weren't thinking about it as an equity issue necessarily. But when we started getting into the data, which is a very large database, and started pulling out the fires that did have electrical indications and looking at where they fell, it became very obvious that they were falling hardest on the north side and a little bit on Milwaukee's south side. So it became clear to us that it's not a risk that falls evenly across communities. And we wanted to look into why that was. The data was difficult to wrangle. I mean, it's just such a massive database and it's not in the easiest format. But what we ended up finding after a lot of wrangling is over the past 10 years, there's about 8,000 home fires in Milwaukee. But because the data is voluntarily reported, the vast majority of them just didn't have enough detail for us to determine if it was an electrical fire or not. And so ultimately, we could only narrow it down to about 300 fires that were electrical in nature in the city over the past decade. And when you look at those, we found that, you know, 2/3 were in majority Black zip codes, almost 2/3 were in rental units, which makes a lot of sense. And like 53206, which is the zip code that we focused on, they were the worst hit. That was a neighborhood where the rate was five times the rest of the city average. And so that's why we focused on there. But it became very clear and very obvious to us early on that it's people who are renters and people who are in these majority Black neighborhoods that are at the highest risk.
John, you mentioned Patricia Colson and Clarence Morrell, who had died in 2019 from an electrical fire in a building with previous electrical building violations. Could you tell us a little bit more about their situation? What happened?
So this was a fire that happened in October of 2019. Patricia Colson, partially disabled, she had worked in various jobs. She was moving into a new property. This was owned by Will Sherrard, who's a landlord in Milwaukee, that he has had a number of issues, run-ins with authorities, unpaid violations, huge sums of money that have been owed. He's been threatened with jail and so forth. He has a long history of having problem properties in the city. She was renting from Will Sherrard another property. She needed to move. He offered her this property. Clarence Morrell was a friend of hers and helping her move in. And literally this fire happened just days after she moved in. And when the tenant downstairs, she smelled what she says in the 911 call, smells like an electrical fire. And it came in as a call, a lower priority call of a possible electrical issue. The firefighters came and they checked the whole house. They got to the second floor at the end of their inspection, and that's when they opened the door and found it full of smoke. But as you mentioned, Mallory, this house had earlier electrical violations recorded by the Department of Neighborhood Services, City of Milwaukee. Those violations required an electrical permit to fix. We did not see, and the city acknowledges this, no evidence that a permit was pulled. So we don't know if that repair work was ever done. We do know that the fire department and then the police department, which does the investigations into these fires, zeroed that the fire appeared to start behind the wall. And what's really interesting then is sort of what happens at that point. And this speaks to the data and the quality of the data. So what happens between October 2019 and today? Typically, you would sort of expect an investigation would follow and sort of the cause of a fire would be pinpointed. But once investigators, and it's not just in the Patricia Colston and Clarence Morrell case, but in many, many cases that we saw, when they see there is not a crime, that it's not arson, that it was appeared to be electrical, it just sort of enters a limbo and the investigation is never really completed. That fire, ultimately, when we look at the numbers that Daphne extracted from the database, that's not included in there. That would be in this big sort of, we think about it like an iceberg of undetermined fires that when you look in deeply, you look at the circumstances, they have all the indications of being electrical fires, but they were not determined to be so. Also, as an aside, the data entry is really problematic, even in a city like Milwaukee. So the deaths, Clarence Morrell and Patricia Colston's deaths were not counted in the data. They're not in the federal data. And that's really particularly, it's very painful for the family on a number of levels. And then the fact that their deaths were not counted and that this fire was not determined to be electrical. And that's important for policymakers. If they don't know that these things are happening, well, that they wouldn't know that there's a problem to address.
Yeah, definitely. And the Journal Sentinel graphics team putting all of Daphne's data together on a map. When you look at that map, all these red dots just pop up. Patricia Colston and her home, that was off of North 14th Street. And you also talked to Ricky Carter, Leilani Zollicoffer, who were victims of an electrical fire a couple blocks away at North 15th and West North. Thankfully, they were able to get out in time, but they're still deeply affected by the electrical fire and their unresponsive former landlord. Could you also talk a bit about that, John, about their situation as well?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that. This is a case that really exemplifies breakdowns across the system. So the property on North 15th Street has a long history of electrical violations that go back at least 10 years. The previous owner of that property and the current owner of that property have failed to fix those electrical problems, as we can see in the documentation, so much so that those cases have been referred to municipal court and warrants for their arrest have been issued, but neither of them have been arrested for those violations. It's all under that backdrop that Leilani Zollicoffer and her two young daughters, 5 and 2, and her boyfriend, Ricky, are moving into this property in November of 2020. They have no idea at this point that there are such problems. And what happens is they move in and they immediately are observing problems with the electrical system, light switches that are not working or that they're flickering lights. Though, again, it's a really difficult situation that somebody like Leilani, who's had evictions on her record and has had problems and difficulty finding housing, she's lived in 53206, for quite a while. And so she's settling for what she can get. And after she's been homeless and so forth, this looks like an opportunity to be settled again. But what happens is late on the night of April 26th of 2021, Ricky's going to getting ready for bed and he observes smoke coming up from the floor of their apartment and realizes something's wrong. Smoke detector is sounding. He goes and wakes up Leilani and the girls and they get out. What the fire department finds is that the fires started between the floors and in the walls. Again, good indication that this is a wiring issue. But again, they have yet to determine that it is fire related. And the result is that Leilani, her girls, and Ricky, again, are homeless. What this case illustrates is, again, repeated warnings that are issued to landlords who refuse to fix life safety issues. And then a tenant, walks into that, unbeknownst to them, into a potentially life-threatening situation.
Yeah, and from your data that Daphne had pulled, race definitely plays a large part in all of this. Janelle Cross, the director of the Metcalf Park Community Bridges Program, in regards to the situation with Carter and Zollicoffer and Zollicoffer's children, she said, quote, "If this was a young white family in a white neighborhood, they would not have been allowed in that house with those code violations." With pulling your data and realizing that the majority of these electrical fires were affecting Black renters, what does that look like in comparison to the rest of the city?
When we looked at these electrical fires or suspected electrical fires, 2/3 of them took place in zip codes that were majority Black. On top of that, in 53206 specifically, the rate was about 5 times that of the city average. I think that one thing that we wanted to highlight is that a lot of these are preventable fires with enough inspections that city has really pulled back on because of a number of laws at the state level. And I think that something that is tragic about all of this is that this is just another one of many, many, many equity issues that affect people on Milwaukee's north side, a lot of which were created by decades of, you know, historical patterns of discrimination, government policies. And so a lot of people, because of this history, may not be able to live in safe housing, you know, may have to choose substandard housing. And this just adds another layer of difficulty to their lives. And I think, like, you know, with an electrical fire, it's very tough to, number one, not be counted. And then number two, not have anything investigated. The lack of agency that creates for families is really tough to overcome on top of losing all of your belongings or being displaced.
With your reporting, it seems that the city and the government is so lax with landlords and how they're being held accountable in situations like these, while renters, on the other hand, have to go through so much scrutiny to obtain housing. Are there any systems in place to hold landlords of faulty property and electricity violations accountable? And why are landlords able to continue renting out property when they have, obviously, an example with Leilani's former landlord, have warrants out for their arrest for these violations?
So the way this goes is that because there's not a proactive inspection program in Milwaukee any longer, they count on complaint-based system. Now, the complaint-based system is valuable, especially with electrical, because you need the account of what people who are living in the property can give. The problem is that since there's already an imbalance between the landlord and tenant, this plays into that power dynamic. Tenants, especially if they've been evicted before, they've got that mark on their record, they do not want to sort of rock the boat and if you will. So they might not call in the violation. Okay, but let's say they do call in the violation, it's documented, and a code violation is issued to the landlord. Well, at that point, presumably a responsible landlord would respond and fix them. But again, if you're playing a short game, maybe you don't fix them because you think, well, this isn't really going to be something that I need to bother with, especially if the electrical system requires some significant work. So I'm just going to ignore these over and over again. That happened in the case of Leilani's landlord, Dominique. We can see that from the records. And, you know, the way it's been explained to me as well is that landlords can basically rent anything as long as the city is not declared to be unfit for human habitation. It's called placarding, you know, where they mark that building, block it off, say it's not. But even then, we see landlords renting those. But that has to be an extreme situation, and the city does that rarely. And the city is standing by their position with respect to Leilani's property. Even after there had been a fire and 10 years of unfixed violations in that house, they're standing by that to say that that should not have been placarded. But all along the way, we saw a system that does not come down particularly hard on landlords and hold them accountable.
Daphne Chen is an investigation and data reporter, and John Diedrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang, and you can find a link to their article at WUWM.com. As as the 20th anniversary of 9/11 approaches, teachers are figuring out how to talk about it with students. The event is recent enough that it may not be thoroughly covered in history textbooks, but far enough in the past that students today may not know much about it. UW-Madison education professor Jeremy Stoddard researches how 9/11 is taught in middle and high schools. His research began in 2003, looking at materials and curriculum that was produced shortly after the attacks. Stoddard's research has continued since then and includes a survey of more than 1,000 teachers in 2018. WUWM education reporter Emily Files spoke to Stoddard about how 9/11 shows up in social studies classrooms.
There's a sort of constant narrative that's very common around 9/11, both in materials as well as what we hear from teachers. And that's partly because it was this burning sort of collective memory event for at least a certain generation of people. And that is that it was an unprecedented attack that, there's heroism in terms of the firefighters, the first responders, that this evil sort of was the cause, evil terrorism. And then that the world came together around the U.S. to sort of respond and to fight back against this evil. And that's a sort of simplistic story, but it's what I think is reinforced in a lot of the media and media coverage of 9/11. I was listening to CNN yesterday, and they're referring to the evil terrorists that were in Afghanistan, during the pullout. So I think this is the rhetoric that we hear a lot still today. So what we find is a lot of teachers, especially U.S. history teachers, because they're constrained by the curriculum that they teach, meaning they may not get up until 1980s even, they're teaching about 9/11 on the day of the anniversary because they think it's important. And a lot of them also want to share their experiences and have students sort of understand their experience on that day because it was this burning event. The thing that we've seen changing, though, is these teachers are also recognizing that students today have no memory of the events and know little about it. So one of the challenges they reported was that students really don't know anything about this coming into their classrooms, even high school classrooms. And what they do know is often misinformed. Maybe it's secondhand from a family member to even finding sort of conspiracy theories online and bringing them into the classroom. So they're recognizing this challenge of they need to be able to provide more context. One of the things we know is a lot of the textbooks in early curriculum, which hasn't necessarily changed that much, was written at a time when everyone had witnessed it. And so they haven't necessarily gone back and revised things for now students who have no clue about it and who view it as a historic event, right? For many teachers still today, it's this current strong memory, but for kids, it's history. And so it's very different. What we're seeing from younger teachers, though, reporting is they want students to understand all the ways that their lives have been impacted by 9/11 and the things that came after it that they wouldn't know about otherwise. And these are especially things around sort of the national security aspects, surveillance, the impact on Muslim Americans, for example, all of these things that they wouldn't know otherwise, TSA, like it didn't exist before, Homeland Security didn't exist before. The way that the U.S. is viewed around the world has shifted to some degree. And it's because they grew up in a time when they didn't necessarily remember the event as strongly, but what they do remember is, the terror threat levels, right? They grew up in a constant sort of state of fear for many years after 9/11 because of that constant threat and the security threat. And so that's what they remember, and that's what they want students to understand is sort of how it's impacted them.
So 9/11 has had such a major impact on life in the U.S. and, the entire world. But what you've found in your surveys of teachers and in surveys of curriculum is that it's treated more as a, like, on the anniversary or around the anniversary, remembering the historic nature of the event and the heroes and the victims. So it's sort of a shallow teaching of 9/11.
This is especially in the U.S. history curriculum, and it's a structural issue in that, if you're in a state, especially in Wisconsin's a little bit different. Wisconsin doesn't have such a strict set of standards for any particular class. So in other states that have an end of course test that's required, say, for graduation, then teachers really feel the pressure to follow the certain chronology and only teach about the events that are going to be tested on. And so in those states, you know, teachers think 9/11 is important, so they're teaching on the anniversary, but they don't feel they have the time to really get into the historical context or tying it into other events. In states like Wisconsin, I think you see a mix. So I know in Madison here, they teach a modern US history course, and they do include it as one of the themes and get into more of those complexities. So it depends a little bit where you are. But yeah, what we found is the majority of teachers, especially in the US history classes, it's still on the anniversary. And because they want to focus on sort of their experiences and having students feel like what it was that day using either a documentary film or some of the news footage from the day, it does tend to reinforce a little bit that narrative of heroism and unprecedented attack and sort of evil Muslim terrorists. I think what we do see is in world history courses, it's generally taught in a much more contextualized way as part of, say, a modern Middle East unit. They tend to tie things together a little bit better, look at the role of the US in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and then how that sort of progressed to lead up to the events of 9/11, and then some of the events that have followed since then in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan and the broader war on terror.
One thing that you found in your research when you looked at curriculum and textbooks was how terrorism is described and the examples of terrorism that are given before and after 9/11 happened. What did you find?
Yeah, so we found two things. One is there was some conceptual confusion over terrorism and that they would give a definition of terrorism, and then the examples that they referred to as terrorism didn't line up with their own definition. So for example, the definition would be, you know, the threat or use of violence against civilians to make a political statement. And then they would use military attacks as an example of terrorism. So the USS Cole, for example. So I think what we found was that there was a blurriness of what terrorism was, and it depends a lot on sort of your perspective and who's on which side. The other piece that we found was throughout the 1990s, there was a larger focus on domestic sort of anti-government groups in the US, white supremacy groups, as being a lot of the primary sort of terrorism or terrorists in the US in terms of these domestic attacks, as well as the IRA, some of the traditional sort of focused on terrorist groups in a world history curriculum, say. After 9/11, you see the focus largely shift toward Muslim terrorist groups. And so even in the state standards, very few include examples of domestic terrorism as part of their state standards, like Oklahoma being one of the clear ones that does because of the bombing at the federal building there. But we do see a shift, and really the focus becomes associating in some ways, you know, Muslim groups with as terrorist groups. And that's one of the things that we've also tried to get teachers to recognize and to make sure that they're being clear in terms of disassociating, you know, a religion or ethnic groups of people with being terrorists.
Is there anything else that you think is important to mention about some of the challenges with teaching about 9/11 or how you think education around it can be improved?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we're seeing is a real limitation and possibly even sort of a little danger of only emphasizing a more nationalistic sort of story as 9/11 as this sort of the unprecedented shocking attack and the heroism and evils of terrorism, is that when we get to something like the Muslim travel ban that was proposed 2 years ago. So that was right around the time that we did the survey. And what we found teachers reporting was that some of that rhetoric was coming into the classroom. There's a really misunderstanding of Islam, of Muslim Americans, and associations of Muslims as terrorists that they were talking about in classrooms. And teachers were really finding that to be both worrisome and challenging, in that many were afraid to open that door because of the political context of engaging in discussions of it, because they're afraid of what some of their students might say, or that some of their students who were Muslim might be harmed by what might be said in the classroom. So I think that's one of the things that we found to be a challenge, and in some of the things that we've put together for teachers, we really try to include sources around what that experience and perspectives of Muslim Americans in particular was after 9/11 and sort of through today, and Sikh Americans as well, because they're misidentified as being Muslim around 9/11. The other piece that was reported a lot is because students now view it as history and don't honestly know much about 9/11, teachers also reported them coming in with misinformation and even conspiracy theories about 9/11, because they're going out and Googling 9/11 and finding some of these videos that are out there. And so one of the things that other teachers talked about, and we've tried to capture some examples of what they use, is using 9/11 a bit as a case study to teach about what a conspiracy theory is, and using it as a way to sort of inoculate students to other conspiracy theories that they're seeing also pop up.
So with what's happening now in Afghanistan, what advice would you give to teachers about how to incorporate current events into their lessons around 9/11?
I think one of the things we have to expect is if students come in not knowing anything about 9/11, they were probably surprised, a lot of people in the US 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, that we still had a large contingent of people in Afghanistan in the first place. I think one of the differences between this conflict over the last 20 years and previous ones like Vietnam or some earlier eras is that it didn't have as much of a broad impact across the US on people in general. So for example, you know, if you were someone who had family members who were victims on 9/11, this is very personal to you. If you've had family members who are in the military or friends, or you're in one of those communities, you're probably more up on the events. And this is much more sort of on a daily basis as part of what you're talking about. If you're not, there's no real impacts on a lot of other Americans. You know, there's no draft. So it's a little bit different in terms of what it would have been in Vietnam. And so I think to that end, if we're not teaching about it in schools, young people may not know a lot about it in general. And so I think this is an area where we can do a lot better job, in particular because if history curriculum are supposed to be the places where we learn about the past so we can understand the present and make better decisions in the future, you know, that's something we don't do very well. And so I think shifting to look at what's going on today and how can we make sense of it because of things that have happened in the past from these different perspectives would be where I would start if I was teaching middle school again right now, for example. So those are the types of things that I would approach. I know a lot of teachers are trying to find ways to really engage their students and help them understand what's going on, you know, the impacts of 9/11 in different ways, but also doing it while also trying to, you know, teach in a pandemic and about a pandemic and all the other things on top of their normal sort of curriculum that they would engage with.
Jeremy Stoddard is a professor and faculty chair of the Secondary Education Program at UW-Madison's School of Education. He researches how educators teach students about the September 11th attacks on the U.S. Stoddard and his colleagues have built a 9/11 education resource guide for teachers, and you can find a link to that at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll speak with the owner of Sap Sap Restaurant, which recently opened a brick-and-mortar location in Racine. But first, soul food scholar and culinary historian Adrian Miller shares the rich history of African-American barbecue culture. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Barbecue is one of America's quintessential cuisines. For centuries, its impact has moved beyond food, building communities and creating a unique culture. That's largely due to African-American barbecue culture and the contributions of Black barbecuers, pitmasters, and restaurateurs. But that history has often been overlooked. Soul food scholar, culinary historian, and barbecue judge Adrian Miller works to restore African Americans to the center of America's barbecue story. He'll be sharing how barbecue is an essential part of Black history in tomorrow's Culture Clash event for Milwaukee Films Cultures and Communities Festival. Ahead of that, he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
So African-American influence in barbecue goes back centuries. And for a long time, I was one of the people who thought, well, yeah, Black people invented barbecue. But one of the biggest surprises in my research is to really understand the Native American foundation of barbecue and how eventually that culinary heritage was passed on to African-American cooks who became barbecue's indispensable cooks. But it's a really, really interesting story.
Can you share some of those general things? I know in the U.S., barbecue can range widely depending on the region you're in, but is there a good general scope of the origins?
Yeah, so we're talking about barbecue in the American South. The birthplace is Virginia. That's where we get most of the early documented history of barbecue. Now, I have to understand that the early history of barbecue is hazy. It's not well documented. And then a lot of the people that did take the time to document, didn't always get it right, or they had an agenda. So you have to sift through a lot of stuff. But it starts in Virginia. And eventually, barbecue becomes very standardized. So even though barbecue was happening in other places, it was pretty much this: cooking a whole animal over a pit filled with hardwood burning coals. And that animal was constantly flipped and turned and seasoned with a vinegar and red pepper sauce, basically. It's more like a flavoring agent. We shouldn't think of it as a condiment. And then served with various side dishes. So that was Virginia barbecue, and eventually became known as Southern barbecue and pit barbecue. But when people talked about a Kentucky barbecue in the early 1800s, it was still that type of cooking. The regional styles that we argue about today, about which one's the best and things, that didn't really show up until the 20th century.
So as a barbecue judge, does the standard of what makes excellent barbecue change much in regard to quintessential flavors, textures, techniques that you look for? Or has barbecue been a unique area of cooking where those techniques and central ideas of it have remained consistent through centuries?
We're in a period of barbecue innovation because not only do we have the standard forms of barbecue, but people are really interested in global flavors. So you're starting to see, people kind of marry traditional barbecue with, say, Latino expressions, Tex-Mex, Asian, and things like that. So you've seen a lot of flavors. But in terms of being a barbecue judge, the dirty little secret is that you're only given kind of structure, right? They tell you to judge based on taste, texture, and appearance. But it's up to you to decide what those things are. They give you some guidelines, but it's really kind of individual taste. So that surprised me because I thought I was going to get more kind of like direction, like, you got to look for this. But no, it's really kind of your own individual taste. And so it's a challenge for a barbecue competitor to know that their stuff is going into this room and, anywhere from 6 to 10 people who they don't know are going to try to assess whether that barbecue is the best.
So what have you found that you're drawn to that makes you think, in your opinion, this is some of the best barbecue I've had?
So for me, the barbecue that I like tends to be tender, but have a little bit of char to it, and then I love a good smoky flavor. And, I like sauce. So a sauce that marries well, and I'm open to different types of sauces. There's just not one go-to sauce for me. I'm open to a lot of different ones. But yeah, I just love how those things go together. But to me, it's really having tender, smoky meat. I really want to have that meat taste like it's been kissed by wood or charcoal or something besides gas. So...
You mentioned you have to kind of shift through somewhat shady history, possibly inaccurate or a lot of deference. So what is your method of researching barbecue and especially the history of barbecue when it comes to African-American and Native American influence on it? And, you've written about this topic, you've given presentations, and I imagine there's some form of disclosure, like this is what we can draw from XYZ, but what are some of the challenges or even favorite aspects of those challenges in trying to hunt down where things can be originated?
Yeah, so the first thing is to go to the primary sources. So, what were indigenous people saying about this type of cooking? What were enslaved West Africans and later enslaved African Americans saying about this? And what were European colonizers saying about this? And the idea is just to put all of those things, line them up, and you try to find contemporaneous accounts, right, to see what people are talking about in that time, how they talked about it. And then a picture does start to emerge. And so that's the real challenge is, first of all, finding the sources and then trying to just ascertain, okay, what likely was going on at this time? How did people think about this? And that helps inform. And then you have to step back and just look at other accounts, right? Travel accounts, secondary sources, stuff, people talking about barbecues as a cooking process, as a food, as a social event, and then you start to see a culture emerge. And then that tends to be very, very helpful. And so, most of my research is from oral histories and also newspapers, because newspapers were about chronicling the what was going on in their community in that day. And so you get a lot more detail in newspapers than you would get in books or other sources. So newspapers were a boon to my research.
One thing that stands out to me is how, if there were origins in Native American, African American, pitmasters, chefs, cooks, barbecue experts, or even just people doing their jobs, or AKA being enslaved to do certain jobs and cook these foods, they didn't know and weren't allowed to learn how to write or teach or write down these recipes. So do you think this is one of the main attributions as to why African Americans haven't been properly attributed and honored in the history and craft of barbecue?
Well, so here's the interesting thing. For several centuries, African Americans were honored in barbecue culture. I mean, you look at newspaper accounts, oral histories, other things. People, the general consensus was that African Americans were the ones who made the best barbecue. And that lasted for a few centuries. It starts to change in the latter part of the 19th century. You start to see more white men getting involved in barbecue, but still they relied on Black labor. You would see pictures of these white men celebrated for barbecue, and then the people actually doing the work were African Americans. It's really only in the last 20 to 30 years that we've had a marked shift from including African Americans in barbecue storytelling. And that I pinpoint that happening in the 90s. You got the emergence of people called foodies. I'm one of them. You know, these people who take pictures of the food, very curious palate, much more adventuresome than their parents. And barbecue was becoming very popular around the same time in the early 90s. And so foodies who were seeking good, authentic food experiences were asking two questions. What is barbecue and where do I get the good stuff? And the people who were in charge of telling those stories and pointing out the experts and the curators kept promoting white men after white men after white men. And so that's in the 90s where we start to see that shift. Because before that, it was no big deal to include African Americans in any story about barbecue, whether it was in print, on film, TV shows, local newspapers. But then we get to the 2000s and almost every major story about barbecue that shows up on TV or in magazines or something excludes African Americans or marginalizes them. And so I'm sitting here thinking like, well, how does that happen? And so I wrote this book, Black Smoke, to really, first of all, just give a thump on the head and say, look, if you're going to talk about barbecue in the United States, you got to include African-Americans and also celebrate African-American barbecue culture and restore African-Americans to the barbecue narrative.
So it's not that legacy was hiding in plain sight. It's just that the legacy was right in front of our faces and we need to reshift the proper recognition to where it was diverted from.
Yeah, because, you know, a diversity critique would have said this country has never acknowledged African-American contributions to barbecue. That would have been the traditional critique, but that's not the case here. I mean, seriously, we have newspaper articles in the 1800s that are saying in order to have an authentic barbecue, you have to have a Negro man or colored man, depending on where you were in the country, which description they used to do this. So it's almost like African-Americans are part of the recipe. Like you couldn't have good barbecue without an African-American involved. So that's how prominent African Americans were. And then if you go back and even in some of the legendary white barbecuers in interviews and stuff, they would say, hey, you know, I was taught this by an African American man, or I watched this African American man do this. And so the legacy even shows up in white barbecue establishments. And a lot of white barbecue establishments would have the white family as the front people. But then if you go in the back in the kitchen, the people who are often doing the work were African-Americans.
So your work involves restoring African-Americans to the center of America's barbecue story. I know there's a plethora of things to choose from, but are there one or two chefs, pitmasters, or restaurateurs you think about specifically that you want to share with listeners today? And, you know, it can be from any period.
Yeah, so two people I really think about a lot is one is a woman named Marie Jean, or Mary John anglicized. And so she was born in Arkansas Territory when it was French. And we have this stray newspaper article, just one article about her superintending a barbecue in 1840 in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And what your listeners need to understand is that superintending was the term of that era for being a pitmaster. So we've got an enslaved Black woman telling dudes what to do in 1840 Arkansas. I think that's extraordinary. And she was hired out. So eventually she buys her freedom. And a lot of people don't know about the hiring out system, but a lot of times enslaved people were hired out to do things. And depending on who was the slaveholder, sometimes they gave a cut to the enslaved person or, you know, had a credit buildup. So she buys her freedom, runs a restaurant in Arkansas Post, which was one of the earliest settlements in that territory. And when she dies in the 1850s, she is eulogized like a great chef. There's some racism thrown in, right? But still, she's eulogized in the majority newspaper. So I just think her life is extraordinary. I wish there was much more about her, but there's just only fragments here and there. So she's the one person, and shows also the deep legacy of Black women in barbecue, because barbecue is often, you know, presented to us as the ultimate dude food. But in African-American community, sisters have been grilling it for a long time. And then another guy I think about is Columbus B. Hill. He shows up in Colorado in the 1870s, and in short order, he's doing barbecues for 5,000 to 10,000 people on the regular. On the July 4th, 1890, when the cornerstone was laid for our state capitol, he did a barbecue for 25,000 people right in front of the state capitol. And then also later that decade, he was supposed to do a VIP barbecue for something called the Stock Show, which is a big deal here in Denver. And it was a VIP barbecue for 5,000, but the word got out in the seedy part of town, and 30,000 people showed up for this VIP barbecue. And needless to say, a riot did break out, and it was a bad scene. So his reputation was a little tarnished from that. But yeah, you know, this is an example of how the Great Migration had brought significant barbecue people to other parts of the country outside the South. He was from West Tennessee, learned the craft there, but, you know, became one of the most prominent barbecue men in the American West. So those are just two examples of kind of the stories I tell in the book.
Adrian Miller is a soul food scholar, culinary historian, barbecue judge, and James Beard Award winner. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow, Miller is taking part in Milwaukee Film's Cultures and Communities Festival in an event called Culture Clash, fusing culinary traditions that bring us together. You can find details about the event at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll speak with the owner of SapSap about how the restaurant is continuing their mission of giving back to the community through food.
The goal has always been to spread our culture through food, telling the stories of our refugee family that came here with nothing, and how important immigrants and refugees are to America. That's what makes this country great to me, is that all these different cultures come from all walks of life, and telling that story.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Around this time last year, we spoke with Alex Hanasakta, the owner of SapSap, about his pop-up restaurant and community-driven values. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang reconnected with him about SapSap's new physical location in Racine, their new sticky rice beer, and what they hope people can learn about Lao culture through their food.
Back in September 2020, you were on Lake Effect and you were still doing curbside pickup and you didn't want to do a brick and mortar quite yet. Now, what had changed since then?
We got a brick and mortar. You know, I always told myself I'd never open a restaurant up until we were just getting so busy in the shared kitchen, traveling from city to city, really no organization because it was a shared kitchen. And we just ran out of space. And I was like, we could open our own place right now, down our operation and offer more SapSap to our fans rather than doing it every other week or once a month.
And just from your social media, it seems like y'all are really busy putting the restaurant together in Racine. You and SapSap have been known for giving back to the community, especially to veterans. And with this new physical location in Racine, what will your mission to giving back look like?
It's nothing really elaborate or fancy. It's just, for instance, we had a veteran come in the other day not knowing that we were giving free meals to vets every week. It's basically just, you know, giving someone that's going through hard times, especially vets, a free meal whenever they need it. We also work with this nonprofit in Wausau, Wisconsin called We Help War Victims. And we donate once a month to them, and we give proceeds of our beer sales to them as well.
This new beer, I know that it was released earlier this year. It's Sticky Rice beer. How is that brewed?
Yeah.
And where did this idea for to brew it come from?
So me and my partner, we were just kind of kicking the idea of having a beer, making a beer. So we contacted a friend of ours that owns a brewery in Burlington, Wisconsin. And he opened not too long ago, but we thought he'd be the perfect guy to kind of help us hone in the flavor of this beer. I mentioned I wanted sticky rice in the beer, and he kind of just went to the lab and created something for us with sticky rice and the notes we wanted in the beer. I know it's controversial, but it does have some relevance. You know, the whole idea was if we can have American drinking frat boy culture help heal parts of Laos, it's a no-brainer with our beer to kind of bring both worlds together, and knowing that they're helping something overseas. The proceeds go to this nonprofit we work with called We Help War Victims. It's funny because this director and food writer from Arizona caught wind of us on our fan page, and she did an interview with us and really wanted to introduce us to this documentary that she did in Laos with her husband. And the guy that they did a documentary on is this guy named Jim Harris that lived in Wisconsin, and we had no idea. So he's a retired principal school teacher that goes back to Laos every year to help remove bombs. She was like, you have to get in contact with Jim. So we got in contact with Jim. We went to go visit him in Wausau, and he has a big museum up there dedicated to Laos and the kind of like the exodus of refugees. Wausau being a really big Hmong and Lao population, you know, it was very, very cool to see his museum and hear his stories. And funny thing is, he used to sell coffee that's straight imported from Laos, and we always wanted to have a sap coffee. So long story short, we might be working with him on our coffee adventure as well. So it's funny. So we buy the beans from him, our proceeds go back to him. So it was like a win-win, and he does great work, man. His heart's really into it. I know a lot of people that, you know, say they're helping, nonprofits that say they're helping, but really, you know, you never really know where that money goes. So this guy's really boots on the ground. Him and his wife do a great, great job of kind of explaining what happened in Laos and what farmers are going through right now.
You guys are busy at SAPSAP. You have the restaurant. Now you're making a beer, very Wisconsin of you. And now coffee, it sounds like, too. And all the proceeds are going back in some way or shape or form back into the community. What do you hope SAPSAP will bring in Racine and within the future of the restaurant?
Just, you know, awareness, solidarity within our community. Funny story. Some gentleman came in there and was a little disgruntled, and he walks in the restaurant and goes, "Where's all the d**ks in here?" And, you know, my friend of the house was a little thrown back, and everyone sitting there was kind of thrown back. I wasn't there. This was conveyed to me. And our friend of the house, you know, started explaining our story, was kind of like, do I kick him out of here? Do I not kick him out of here? It was just all instinct and spontaneous. But he handled it very well, and he mentioned our story and how Lao and Hmongs fought with the Americans during the war, our help with veterans, and that kind of made him just like flip a 180. He kind of regretted saying that. But, you know, that just that explanation to someone that's so ignorant to say that and come into an Asian restaurant, to have that change his mind instead of like, you know, arguing with him or kicking him out, you know, that self-reflection of him not knowing, you know, what we do, or really our story is our power. Our food is our weapon, and it's all about educating people through food and culture with our history.
Hearing that word as an Asian person, as an Asian person, that's sure. Very like shocking and very frustrating.
Oh God, it was.
You know, like it's very shocking to have that thrown at you. So I commend the patience of your front of house staff.
I felt the same way. I was really, really frustrated and was going to track him down and yada, yada. But I was like, you know, if he left there feeling like he learned something, that, you know, that's our main goal, is to educate people.
And it sounds like even just by being a part of the community too is creating so much change and having people come to learn more about Laos, more about being Asian and Asian American within race scene in Wisconsin. What are some of your future goals that you have for yourself with SAFSAP?
My staff and the people that are close to me think I'm crazy because I have all these ambitious goals and things I want to do. And it's kind of like right now, it's like SAFSAP run amok right now because everything's kind of crazy. But, you know, we definitely want to launch our coffee. We want to launch more beer products. We want to open another location, maybe down the road in Milwaukee and Burlington, Wisconsin. This is all long-term though, obviously. But ultimately, the goal has always been to spread our culture through food, telling the stories of a refugee family that came here with nothing, and how important immigrants and refugees are to America, and just be woven in the fabric of. That's what makes this country great to me, is that all these different cultures come from all walks of life, and telling that story.
Alex Hanasakta is the owner of SAFSAP. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how 9/11 continues to affect the ways we report on and interact with the news. Plus, we'll tell you what to expect from this weekend's Milwaukee Short Film Fest. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.